What's wrong with the world? What is wrong with the world? What's wrong with the world? In the past week, how many times have you asked that? Do you watch the news? Do you read the paper? Have you heard about something awful that's happened to a family down the street? As you hear some news from a family member, get a call or a text or an email, and haven't you thought to yourself, what's wrong with the world? As we work through the first chapters of Genesis, we've seen exactly what's wrong with the world. We're what's wrong with the world. Sin is what's wrong with the world. But as the title of this series that we've looked at, Creation and Curse, makes clear, there's more to it than just that. Because if it was just human evil and human sin against our Creator, then the solution will be straightforward. Stop sinning. Stop being evil. Create a world in which we control our environment so well that we eliminate all human suffering and sorrow. What's really wrong with the world is that God cursed it. The whole of the earth, the whole of the natural order, is under the ban of the Lord. Because of the sin of humanity, God subjected the creation to frustration. That's a big problem. It's the big problem. It's the driving force behind all human religion and civilization and technological development. It requires a big solution. Today, in this chapter, we're going to look at two different responses to this big problem. Two different plans to fix this broken world we're living in. Mankind's plan and God's plan. Look at verses 1 to 9. In these verses we see mankind's plan. Now we're going to spend a little longer looking at this, by the way, so if you start looking at the clock wondering why I'm taking longer, it's because we are just taking about twice as long on this. Well, in the account of the Tower of Babel, we see just how humanity, how mankind, thinks they can reverse the effects of the curse. Now, we've already said this is a big problem. It needs a big solution, and I think mankind in chapter 11 clearly understand that, because their solution is to build a whopping big tower. A tower that reaches to the heavens, verse 4. Now we know this story. We can see the artwork in our mind's eye, you know, the great Renaissance paintings, or in the storybooks of this vast round tower. It looks a bit too much like the Colosseum in Rome, usually, but you know, you can see it. But if you look carefully at these verses, I think you might realise that we've actually mislabeled this account. And the publishers of our Bibles, where it says, the Tower of Babel, have mislabeled this account. It's kind of obvious once it's pointed out to you. It's one of the reasons that makes clear what man is trying to do is, in fact, to reverse the curse. That's what he wants. That's his aim here. And the first clue to this is in verse 2. It says, as people moved eastward. Now think back to man's exile in chapter 3. In Genesis, eastward is the direction of exile. It's the trajectory we've been on since the fall. The direction Cain walked off in after he'd murdered his brother in chapter 4. There's another clue there. Because what did Cain do after he was condemned by God to live as a wanderer? What was meant by that was that Cain was given the opportunity to submit to God's word and show he was actually sorry for what he'd done if he'd obeyed God and lived as a wanderer. After he'd been given a protective mark to prevent him being hounded and killed as a murderer he was. He started building a city. Now we're inclined to make much of the Tower of Babel because it looks good in paintings. You know, you can do the Sunday school and get the Duplo out and build a tower. But we forget that the tower is, in every case in this passage, a footnote to the city which mankind was building. We should name this the story of the city of Babel, but I don't think it'll catch on. We're too used to it now, and it's not a big problem. The tower serves to help us understand the purpose or significance of the city. Just why this city was being built, what it meant. And that's important because the Bible isn't anti-urban. It's not anti-city per se. It doesn't say we should all go and live like nomads east of Eden. Think about how a city's landmarks can tell you something of the character of its people. You know, the great temple of Artemis in Ephesus, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It showed what the Ephesians were really interested in. It showed where their hearts were. Or think of the great arenas and hippodromes of ancient Rome. They spoke powerfully of what ordinary people really cared about. You know, blood sports and horse racing. Look at in Constantinople, the great city, the Rome of the East, as they called it. And one of the biggest buildings there was the hippodrome, the horse racing, chariot racing thing. And Constantinople was famous for the riots that would start between the Blues and the Reds, the two competing teams. And you could tell that just by looking at the building. What's the biggest building in the city? The horse racing centre. That's going to be the most important place. And I think of what the Statue of Liberty meant when she was built. You know, a gift from France, made from Norwegian copper, welcoming immigrants like my great-grandfather to the land of the free. Now the shipyards at Barrow are like that. You just have to see them dominating the skyline to realise that this is why Barrow exists. It's why it's there. To create those, you know, magnificent, incredible submarines. But in the city of Babel, they built a tower. What do we make of that? It might not be clear to us, but it would have been clear to the Israelites who originally heard Moses speak these words. And it's there in the verse, in verse 3, the explanations right in front of us. In Israel and Egypt, monuments were made from quarried stone because it was easy to get. You wouldn't have to go too far to get stone, dig it out, and build your important buildings out of it. But in Mesopotamia, in Babylon, where their ancestors had come from, stone wasn't readily available. It's, you know, big kind of muddy plains. Important buildings, the ones you wanted to last, were made out of baked bricks, sealed with bitumen. It's excellent waterproofing. And in that context, the important buildings, the towers like this, were a normal sight. They were called ziggurats, or ziggurat, depending on how you transliterate it. And it was a kind of stepped pyramid. Now, though the different layers could have different symbolic importances, the tower itself was just an architectural support for the staircase that ran from its top. That staircase was meant as a convenient means for their god, or gods, to come down to his or her temple, which would be built at the bottom of the ziggurat, at the bottom of the tower. The Tower of Babel, therefore, was meant to be an enormous staircase to and from heaven. Now, there's a couple of ways, actually, to read this, although they mean the same thing. Either mankind wanted a staircase into heaven to make a name for themselves by becoming God, kind of like an attempt to storm the barricades of heaven. Or else, another possibility, they meant to domesticate God. Make a name for themselves by bringing God down. An attempt to harness God, to be the guards of God's house. To have a name and security and fame and might and power by possessing the means of making God behave in the way they wanted. Either way, whichever there is more right, and there's probably a bit of something to both. Babel was a city dedicated to undoing the effects of the curse by man's own ingenuity and industry. Despite the religious implications of the tower they were building, the fact that this was clearly related to worship, they never tried talking with God. Did you notice that? They never asked God what to do or what he wanted. They discussed it among themselves. Let us build, let us bake. But it's clear that the inclination of man's heart here is one of rebellion. They're defying God, defying the curse he pronounced. So that's what mankind's plan was. But just look at the effect that man's plan has in verse 5. Now, there's deliberate irony here. This is a wonderful example of how well written the Bible is. They build this enormous tower that reaches into the heavens. And God has to come down. Did you notice that? He has to come down to see what's going on. The staircase, which was perhaps intended to force God down and secure his blessing, instead brings judgment. I wonder if any of you were confused by what God says in verse 6. Now, from what he says, it seems like this. If mankind is allowed to follow through on their plan, it will be successful. Nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. That's what God says. Now, remember, at this stage, which chronologically at least comes before chapter 10, mankind has one language, one shared vocabulary, one purpose. Working together, they will achieve it. They'll be able to build a society that many of the effects of the curse would have been removed from or reduced. Most people would have lived longer, happier lives. They'd have been wealthier. There'd have been more food available. But given the nature of this city, how do you think they'd have spent those extra years? The extra time given by a well-ordered society? Their attitude towards God is, as we've seen, at best, like a cosmic vending machine. Now, you put prayers in, you put worship in, get sacrifices in and you get blessings out. God is a service to be used. You burn the incense at the temple, God comes down and gives you the good stuff. At worst, their attitude is one of hostility. God is an enemy to be conquered. Heaven is a domain for man to include in his empire. We see it in our own society. We see it all over the world. Self-sufficiency and material prosperity produce alienation from God. A man satisfied in his physical needs is often too distracted to pay any attention to his spiritual needs. If God had permitted Babel to be built, then civilization after the flood would have been worse than civilization before it. God's scattering of mankind, his confusion of their languages, which prevented the work from continuing, was actually, therefore, a great act of mercy. It was a colossal check to the evil of which he would have committed if he could have carried on. Now, you know, sort of swing ropes that kids build. Just like we used to do it, or find one down on Bardsey Beach, because there's some really good spots where you can hang. There's plenty of rope that washes up, and driftwood. You get a branch, get a rope, you tie that round that, and you tie this swing from a tree branch. And on Bardsey Beach, there's some really good bits where the trees overhang. So you can get onto this swing, and then you're 30 or 40 feet, maybe, 20, above the shingle. You really feel, you know, catch some air, it's great. Now, if a parent takes down that rope, because they can see that that rope is going to snap, and the child sulks, the child's had its fun spoiled, but hasn't that parent done a wonderful thing for that child? Prevented them from falling 30 or 40 feet onto a shingle beach. We have to be very careful in the world we live in. Our own cleverness and technology can help reduce many of the effects of the curse. We start to think life's not so bad. With a full belly, roof over our heads, antibiotics for our illnesses, labour-saving technology that gives us more free time, we might think we've got it beat. What need do we have for all that sombre, serious, old-time religion? Why bring God into it at all? We're having a good time. Don't go spoiling it. Of course, this view of eat, drink and be merry immediately comes a cropper the second anything goes wrong. Where do you turn when comfort becomes impossible? When there's a financial crisis and all your money disappears? When you get a diagnosis that the best doctors in the world can't deal with? Mankind then, as now, attempted to undo the curse himself. That was the plan. But the result would have been disaster. They would have achieved something, but it would have ended in absolute destruction. Be warned. It's not wrong, it's not a sin to be comfortable. It's not wrong to make to use technology to make human life more pleasant. But it can't be what you're living for. It can't be what you build your life around. Well, that was mankind's plan. But in the genealogy of verses 10 to 26, we get a reminder of God's plan. Man's plan, now God's plan. It's, I suppose, not immediately apparent from the straightforward list of names in front of us, but put it in the context of the wider story. Pay attention, as ever, to the details. Now, there's two main components to this. The first is simply in who this family tree, that's what a genealogy is, a family tree, who it connects us to. Because it takes us from Noah's son Shem all the way through to Abraham. Now that's the man that the Israelites, hearing this, immediately recognise as their ancestor. So, oh, we know him. That's, you know, great, 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 however many greats, grandfather Abraham. We know him. We know the stories. We get that you are connecting that people to us. It takes us all the way, this genealogy, from the man who survived the flood to the man who'd be made great, great promises by God. Now in the last chapter, in the table of the nations, we see the rise of the nations. And we actually saw, if you flick back the page, the first genealogy of Shem. This is the second genealogy of Shem that we've got within a few chapters. They kind of bookend this account of Babel. And if you want to compare them, you'll notice that this one in chapter 11 is much more direct. It goes from father to son. It doesn't sort of branch out in the way that the one in chapter 10 does. It goes direct all the way to Abraham and his brothers. Now, if you look ahead to chapter 12, it might just be in front of you. You might have to turn the page. And you'll see in those first few verses, God's tremendous promise to Abraham. Now, it's a deliberate comparison. Compare Babel with Abraham. At Babel, mankind planned to make a great name for himself by the graft of his own hands. But in chapter 12, God promises to make Abraham great, to make his name great. At Babel, mankind tried to snatch blessing from God's hands. It's like Jack trying to climb the beanstalk and run off with the goose that laid the golden egg. In chapter 12, Abraham is simply told to hold out his hands and receive the blessing God is going to give him. And it's an unconditional promise. All Abraham has to do is believe. Trust in what God has said. So that's the first thing. You know, Shem to Abraham and the promises that were made. The second is actually in what the passage doesn't say. It's a kind of a negative space thing. Now, it's funny how our lack of attention and our difficulty, I think as modern Westerners, in reading repetitive parts of the Bible, and it's hard going, I think we can admit that, but it can blind us to the amazing things it has to tell us. Just this list of names and dates and ages. Now, you compare, you can turn to it if you want, or just in your mind, compare this genealogy to the one in chapter 5. I don't know if you remember that. In almost every single way, it's structured identically. It starts the same way. This is the account of so-and-so's family line. And the genealogy carries on in the same way. It's got kind of the same formula. When P was Q years old, he became the father of R. After he became the father of R, he lived 6 years... or S years, and had other sons and daughters. And there, if you're looking, the similarity ends. If you compare this to chapter 5, what's missing? And then he died. Now we notice that in this genealogy, the lifespans start to be significantly reduced. No one's really living to be 950 years old anymore. It's, you know, kind of dropping a few hundred years every generation until we get to a regular 70, 70. But that refrain, that and then he died, and then he died, and then he died, is missing. Now we know that all these men died. It tells us how old they were. But it's not being hammered home. The curse of death isn't being spotlighted the way it was in chapter 5. God is holding out the hope in this family line that the curse will one day be reversed. Through Abraham's line, one will come who will conquer the grave. One will come who will defeat death. Don't miss in Genesis that this is the start of the story that will lead us all the way through to Jesus. I've kept repeating this throughout this series, but God's plan all along was to bless mankind. We saw it right from the earliest chapters. We see it in every chapter. But like the Israelites in the wilderness, not trusting God to give them enough manna, hoarding it up despite his clear intentions, mankind seems to be constantly doubting God and trying to bless himself. We want to strong arm God into giving us stuff. We want to force his hand. We want to be blessed on our own terms. No, don't bless me like that. Bless me like this. But think about that for a second. We want God to bless us in the way we choose, at the time we choose, in the precise means we choose. We don't trust God to do us good, so we try to use religion to force him to act. We build towers and temples and try to cajole and control him. But if it's the intention of the Almighty God to bless us, if it's the plan of our Creator to do us good, then don't you think that he is the best person to decide how that's going to be done? Doesn't he know what's best for us? What will bring us the most joy? I started by asking, what's wrong with the world? And I don't think anyone could disagree with me that for all the beauty and the wonder that we see in life, for all the glory and the kindness of which man, you know, whether they're a believer or not, of which men and women are capable, we still live in a messed up earth. Technology might keep us alive a little bit longer, make our lives a little bit more comfortable, but it can't, for all its ingenuity, wipe away our every tear. There's a lot that it just can't fix. Many of our best efforts have actually made things worse. We're a kind of poison chalice. What about nuclear power? A wonderful clean energy that produces so much radioactive waste, we can't deal with it. Think of the invention of plastic, this wonderful new material that doesn't degrade, only it doesn't work as well as we want it to, and we've polluted the whole planet with it. Our misuse of antibiotics has made some illnesses stronger. Now we cure heart disease so that more people live to develop diseases like Alzheimer's. Like the ancient Mesopotamians who built the most wonderful canals to irrigate their farmland. You know, the rivers of Babylon that were famous across the world. But over time, the tiny bit of salt in that water would build up in the ground until it could no longer support life. The plain where Babel was built is now a desert wasteland because of man's plan. Now we've seen these two different solutions to the problem of the curse. The attempt to remove its effects, to make ourselves comfortable in the wreckage we've made of God's creation. It is not wrong to seek to have pain or discomfort reduced. Please don't think I'm saying that. But is that where you should invest all your hopes? Are you going to try to live your life for something which only promises to make you slightly more comfortable for the 70 years and 10 you've been allotted? At its best, this is a palliative solution. Symptom control, pain management. At its worst, it becomes a turning in on ourselves and trying to make a name for ourselves until we're so crooked we can never be made straight again. Hateful self-obsession, self-worship, like a snake eating its own tail. But the other solution is a solution that takes it completely out of our hands. It's a solution to the curse that doesn't rely on human ingenuity or wisdom. It's God's plan to send his Son into the world to pay the price for the sin that caused him to curse the world. With that debt settled, with the accounts balanced, It's possible for God to put us into a new world, a new creation, where there is no curse, where there is no sin spoiling our enjoyment of Him. A world that, because of the fall, we don't even have words to describe. How can a child imagine what life's going to be like before it's been born? Today, if you want to know that your future is assured, make the right choice. Trust in the right plan. Don't try to make a name for yourself, but accept the only name worth trusting in, the name of Jesus.